WISE Awards are back for 2024 and early bird entries are still open. These awards recognise the best use of digital media, marketing and commerce, and they also celebrate innovation and expertise right across the digital marketing industry. There are more categories than ever before to enter, so visit exchangewire.com/events to find out more.
The MarTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to the ExchangeWire MarTech Podcast, bringing you the latest from the worlds of media, marketing and e-commerce. I'm your host, John Still, and I'm delighted to be joined for today's episode by Rachel Smith. Rachel, lovely to have you.
Thank you very much for inviting me back on the podcast.
Always welcome. I am absolutely thrilled as well to be joined by our special guest today, who is Claire Turner, who is Chief Commercial Officer for Pearl & Dean. Claire, welcome.
Thank you very much, John.
No, I'm absolutely delighted to have you. Yeah. The Pearl & Dean theme tune has been in my head for about 30 years, so I'm really pleased to have someone from Pearl & Dean joining us.
Yeah, I won't make you sing it, but you know, if you want to, feel free.
Oh no, my fiancé had quite enough of that last night. Maybe I'll put it in at the end, a little Easter egg for you all.
Change the theme tune. We need a new theme tune.
We are due an update. But that one stood the test of time, hasn't
it? Yeah, yes, it was our 70th birthday last year.
Yeah, fantastic. That's amazing.
Fantastic. Yeah. Mm. Cool. Right. Yeah. I will kick us off with our first story, which is that Netflix is dominating UK SVOD services. More than 20 million homes in the UK are now subscribed to a subscription video on demand service, and Netflix alone counts for 17.1 million, beating all the other streaming platforms operating in the region. That's big news for Netflix. I know it's a very fragmented marketplace, but they are really, you know, they're still pulling people in. The ad-supported tier is growing. Rachel, how are they doing it, and how can anyone take the crown off them?
Well, I'm no
pun intended.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yes. Not sure about removing Netflix's crown, but I often feel like Netflix success, particularly here in the UK, is reflective of the TV infrastructure that we've got in this marketplace. So what I'm talking about there is a TV environment where, prior to Netflix, a TV consumption environment where consumers were used to really high quality content with very low ad saturation. Obviously, also great quality content on via the BBC, where you didn't have any ads at all. But even the standard UK broadcasters have been responsible for producing kind of world leading television content, and consumers here haven't had to endure the same volume of ads that they have in other English speaking markets like the US or Australia. And so I think that's underscored what people expect from a TV platform of any description. And so obviously one of, you know, Netflix's big selling points and most of the streamers when they first came about was the opportunity to watch television without ads. But I think it goes beyond that now, because, you know, we are expecting great quality content. We're also expecting a reasonable quality advertising experience. Mm-hmm. And I've been saying this, you know, for at least 2 months now. I think Netflix's transition to ad-funded model and what they did with their lowest tier of subscribers here in the UK and probably in other global markets too, by just shunting them straight onto the ad-funded tier and giving them a discount, was a piece of genius, because it's reminded me how actually if you're consuming ads in a high quality content environment and the ads are sympathetic and they're good quality, they're not actually that disruptive. So I feel as though the things that Netflix is offering, which is good quality content and low saturation of ads, aligns with the average UK consumer.
Yeah. And is actually very similar to cinema. It's high quality content, and it is, you know, a small amount of quality ads before you watch your, you watch your film.
Yep.
I think as well, if we look at the data, John, I think really there's another couple of little things at play. I think it's a bit of a perfect storm for Netflix. Yes, obviously content is king. They have some fantastic content. But I think also they've benefited from the fact, the crackdown on subscriptions last year. So we're seeing more people, if they want to watch it, they have to subscribe. So that's driving some growth. And I think also the fact that Netflix have really great diversity in content. And I'm talking about, you know, subtitle content, you know, foreign language TV shows and films, you know, they are good for world cinema, has just meant that, you know, if we look back to the second half of last year, we had the actors' strike and the writers' strike. So Hollywood production for TV shows and film were impacted. So because they have got this, you know, diverse range of content, it's meant that it's mitigated really that sort of that sort of gap and that sort of lag in that Hollywood content, and it's meant they've still got great original content to show with their audiences. So do I think that they will continue to grow? Yes. You know, it is a mature market. So whether it will be at the pace that we've just seen quarter on quarter, I'm not sure. Time will tell.
Yeah, do you think there's also some first mover advantage for them, or just brand recognition, the fact that they've been going for so long?
Yeah, I think. I mean, they were the first. I was listening in prep for this chat, Diary of a CEO with the, you know, with the ex-CEO of Netflix, and it was 1997 that they launched, you know, and I was one of the early adopters. So I had the sort of DVD, you know, postal service, which was fantastic.
But it's interesting, right? Because the DVD postal service was, there was a Love Film brand, which then got bought by Amazon, who were obviously one of Netflix's main competitors, but Netflix just absolutely took over, right?
Yeah, they did. And, you know, just that growth trajectory, first to market, you know, a recognised brand, and the fact that they have, you know, this breadth of offering, I think, versus the perceptions of some of the other streaming platforms, which might just be family or, you know, really sort of highbrow content. Netflix is like the four quadrant, which is what you say about, you know, in my world, in movies, when they appeal to, you know, the different sectors, broader families, much broader. So I think Netflix, you and Straw Poll have won, you know, that is my, I keep that subscription in this sort of cost of living crisis. When people are looking at how much they're spending on streaming, I think Netflix is maybe the one that you keep, and then you dip in, dip out of maybe some of the others, depending on what new shows that they've got.
Yeah, I think it's exactly the same for me. Netflix is the constant of the different streamers. And then maybe if there's a movie I want, then I'll pick up that for a month. Or if there's something on the sport I want to watch, I'll pick up that for a month. Yeah. But Netflix has all bases covered. But streaming is growing as an industry by itself, Rachel, you know, not just Netflix, but the other streamers are growing too. How do you see this momentum keeping up? Do you think streaming is taking traditional TV's role?
I mean, I think that streaming will definitely continue to rise. I think more and more people that are perhaps not currently streaming, so let's think about an older demographic of consumers, will eventually move over to streaming platforms. But then I also think streaming popularity will continue to grow and diversify amongst the existing population who are already streaming and maybe have, you know, their fundamental SVOD service like Netflix and dip in and out of the others, as you mentioned. But I therefore think that that means there's still a lot of growth for those competitors. They've got an opportunity not just to become the, you know, a sort of bite-sized content option for people. I mean, I do exactly the same thing. Netflix is the standard for me. And then occasionally if I want to watch something that's off that platform, I might just purchase it as a one-off if it's a film or something like that. So I think you'll definitely see more of that happen. But I also think that just means there's more, it will create a little bit more fragmentation, which means competition. And I do think that there's still a lot of room for growth for the other largest competitors anywhere close to Netflix. And that would be Amazon Prime, maybe Disney Plus, but they're still miles away from Netflix's penetration. So where I see the ceiling, I suppose, in the industry is in terms of viewing hours and viewing time. And I think that's what people will start to make their decisions about what they pay for and what they consume based on what's available, the quality of what's available and the time that they've got available and the platforms that they're using. Yeah. I think your point as well, Claire, about the type of content, the original content that Netflix is generating is really interesting too, because prior to the ad-funded model, when we discussed Netflix in the context of the advertising and marketing world for years and about whether they would go ad-funded or not, I've always wondered how infinitely deep their pockets are, because it's not cheap to produce that quality of content. And you're really right about the fact that when there was a dearth of fresh content available, they still had, everybody was sort of saying, well, Disney Plus will have an inexhaustible back catalogue, so they'll do really well in that environment. But it's content that tends to appeal to a particular genre and a particular demographic, right? So, you know, that might be just perception, but that's how it tended to unfold. And actually, it turns out Netflix has got a massive volume of original content that they hadn't released or stuff that was local language that hadn't yet been released in certain markets. And I think that's a really interesting point. You know, they're producing content that isn't being produced elsewhere, that's owned by them. They are also normalizing, as you mentioned earlier on, the concept of consuming content with subtitles. So, you know, that's where I think they've also got another competitive advantage.
And I think the, you know, the challenge for them will be, you know, we are in a mature market, streaming market, you know, the older subscribers are probably masking a bit of a fall off in the younger ones. And it's just making sure, so they've pledged $17 billion to create original productions this year alone. So whether that blend of, you know, if subscribers are plateauing, we need that sort of ad, or they need, should I say, the ad revenue, you know, which is projected to be around 30% by 2028, to sort of step up and make sure that there is that production pot to create this, you know, this great content. You know, they do, you know, they are good at you know, at sort of bringing in the youngest, what they did with Top Boy. You know, they revisited, it was Channel 4, wasn't it?
Originally. It was originally on Channel 4.
And then Drake got involved.
Decided he liked it,
And then, you know, that would have brought a whole new demographic to it. And Squid Games, again, that had all the kids watching it.
Absolutely.
So that real sort of zeitgeist moment, sort of, you know, cultural moment, really. It's about them continuing to be able to do that.
Yeah, and of course they are dipping their toes into other waters as well. Netflix, they've moved into sport recently, streaming live sports such as the NFL games that they'll be showing at Christmas, which does lead me on to our next story, which is that Fox has nearly sold out its Super Bowl ads before the end of summer. One buyer has predicted that Fox could sign up all of its sponsors by September. In comparison, CBS hadn't declared ad space to be sold out until November of last year, and the game is in February, so this would be a very early sellout for Fox. Rachel, why do you think demand for that ad space for the Super Bowl is high this year?
So firstly, lucky Fox. I mean, imagine being in that position. And then secondly, I think demand for that type of ad space is directly correlated with the scale available. So, you know, the Super Bowl has always been massively popular, obviously, but I feel as though those moments, shared moments of content consumption are becoming even more precious. So not saying that people that are going to be tuning into the Super Bowl haven't always done that. They've, you know, they'll have an enormously loyal audience. But I feel as though the fragmentation of the way that we generally consume content has led advertisers to understand the value of those moments. And I think, therefore, that's increased the value, right? It's a bit of a supply and demand piece of economics. At the end of the day, advertisers are more interested in getting involved in those moments than they ever were before, because they understand not just the value of the scale, but I think that that scale is otherwise very difficult to achieve across other channels. And we all know that, you know, people's attention spans and the way that they consume content has changed so dramatically that it feels as though those moments are precious. And even if we think about the great sporting summer that we've just had, the Olympics, the Summer Olympics, with the Paralympics coming up shortly, and then obviously the Euros, I still think viewing of those types of sporting events is much more fragmented than something like the Super Bowl. I just think there's you know, evidently, as advertisers' pockets would indicate, almost infinite value in getting yourself in front of that audience.
Claire, what do you think on this one?
Rachel, you're right. I mean, those moments of, I mean, 123 billion, million,
yep.
123 million people watched Super Bowl in February, and it is so rare to access that volume of people. But I also think if we look sort of at the data and we look at what happened last year about why perhaps they were a little slower to sell out. You had the whole sort of crypto crash. So back in 2022, I think, well, maybe four or five or quite a few crypto brands that were part of the Super Bowl ad reel. And then they were obviously interested again for this year. And then everything happened, FTX and all that business. So they would probably found themselves with a bit of a gap. Whereas, and another, I guess another really big thing that we should mention is the Swiftie phenomenon. So, I mean, Taylor Swift, you know, the girlfriend of Taylor Kelce, and all the Swifties, you know, I think the number one selling football shirt is Taylor Kelce's. So you've got this whole other audience and this whole other demographic who will be watching next February. So, and I think you've also got, again, parallels, sorry, indulge me, I will pull it back to cinema, is that as a brand, you know that you are keeping incredibly good company in that reel. You know, you're up against the best. You know, it's the best creative. It's often bespoke creative that's, you know, the fact that they tease the bloody ads, you know, before they are revealed on the, I mean, that's just nuts, isn't it? So I think you've just got that high quality and the sort of humour element to it, and just people are even more interested in what the advertisers are doing than what is, I mean, I can say this as a Brit, I'm sure that I'd be shocked.
You're not a massive American football fan.
So, but yeah, this sort of noise around the ads is almost as big as the game, but it is
interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, my understanding is that audiences for American football are growing outside the US as well. You know, they've been playing some games in the UK, and I can remember not long ago being on the Elizabeth line, and there was a whole bunch of Americans who were in town that must have been holidaying. I can't imagine they'd come here to see it, and there was some game on at Wembley, American football game at Wembley, and they were getting into chit chats with people on the train who were just asking them about it, and next thing you know, there's a description of the rules going on, and I'm thinking to myself, it's absolute organic brand extension, right? Which is what every brand is after. And I think that you're right, all of those things have coalesced to make the Super Bowl even more famous than it was before. And I think you've also pinpointed one of the reasons that advertisers like it is because those ad slots are going to be considered entertainment, not necessarily just about selling products. And we've seen that with you know, the introduction of famous Hollywood actors being a key linchpin to some of those ads. And I've done, like the John Lewis Christmas ads, done what everybody else did that isn't a Super Bowl fan, which was Google the Matt Damon, you know, Ben Affleck, J-Lo Super Bowl ads. So, you know, everyone wants a piece of that pie.
And when you think what it can do for brands, so is it Tubi, who no one had ever heard of? Just, it was one of the most talked about, from like no one knowing really what it was all about, because I mean their ad was very clever. It was a real disruptor. You know, people thought that they'd actually accidentally sat on the remote and switched the channel. So I think the fame that it can deliver for a brand, yes, it's $7 million for a 30-second spot, so it's a, you know, but you're getting 123 million viewers. So the blend of the fame, that if you get it right as a brand and you create something which will just, everyone's talked about, I mean, that is just gold dust. But then I think also we've got this whole shared experience growth, which you mentioned, Rachel. And if you look at the latest Bellwether report, you know, from the IPA, you are seeing that advertisers are really seeking out these moments which are reaching, you know, people together. Attentive audiences, they're not second screening, again back to cinema, so you have this real this real moment where you are reaching everyone together and creating, you know, shared response, you know, whether you're laughing, whether you're shocked, whether you're surprised, you know, when it's multiplied by, you know, everyone experiencing that together, it's you know, it's a rare thing. And it's rare for brands to be able to use media to create that.
Yeah, I think, you know, you've hit on a couple of really interesting points there around cinema as well. One, you know, one being the Taylor Swift effect, and obviously cinema had a little boost from the Eras tour going into cinemas.
Yeah.
And then cinema had its own Super Bowl moment last year with Barbenheimer, which the world went crazy for. And it was this pop cultural phenomenon that that really got people involved.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, the fact, yes, obviously a brilliant marketing campaign from Warner's and Universal, but, you know, the fact that it was just taken over by the people, you know, socially, all the memes, all the mashups, and it just sort of grew and grew and just, you know, went, it was a real sort of firework moment in time. So the Barbenheimer was just the gift that kept on giving for us.
More please. but also probably for a whole bunch of other brands that might have been wrapped up in it. You know, there were so many that I suppose is the joy of those viral moments, is that it's not just about what happens in that moment or for an ad, the brand that was associated with that ad or created that ad. It's everything else that happens around it. Yeah. That enables potentially smaller brands to get engaged and involved in that type of level of advertising, because teeny tiny brands are never going to be able to afford $7 million to advertise at the Super Bowl, but they might be able to do activity off the back of what happens in and around that event and in and around those ads that gives them some kind of share of voice.
Yeah.
That is the beauty. That's the sort of the good side and the upside of our heavily digitized lives and our Uber connections to everything and everyone. There's plenty of downsides, but that's a good upside.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it was great to see for cinema. They got that boost after, you know, just opening up after COVID and really got people involved.
Yeah, and people who might not have been for a while just, you know, had to go see it. Yeah. And it's exclusively in cinemas. So, you know, that really that mindset shift post-COVID, where we're now back to, you know, films having exclusive windows, and even the streamers creating content, which they know cinema is a shop window, and, you know, elevates the, well, let's face it, the revenue generation potential for a film. You have the exclusivity in cinema, then the longer tail as it moves onto the small screen.
Yeah, it moves us nicely on actually to our final story, which is that the UK entertainment and media market is set to $155 billion by 2028. According to a forecast by PwC, the UK's entertainment and media market is on track to become the largest in Europe by 2025, set to surpass £100 billion this year. Streaming services and cinema are set to play a pivotal role, which must be music to your ears, Claire.
Yeah, absolute music to our ears. And not surprising, actually. You know, if we go back to 2019, we were just on such an upwards trajectory. You know, we had the highest number of visits. We had the highest revenue. You know, we were absolutely flying. And then obviously March 2020, you know, that all changed. So it has taken, you know, a while for, you know, people get into habits, you know, especially family films. You know, they were available on streaming. I mean, obviously for Disney Plus, they launched in the middle of a pandemic. So, you know, great timing for them. And, you know, the fact that people are now recognising that if you want to see a big movie, it is, cinema is the only place that you can do it. And the fact that the streamers are, as I mentioned, releasing in cinemas first. So, and we also had, things were building back, getting stronger and stronger. Then we had the writers and actors strike, which obviously delayed things somewhat. So if we look at the content for this year, for the back half of this year or moving into Q4, there's just some amazing films like, you know, Gladiator with Paul Mescal, which I can't wait for. Wicked Part 1, which it will be, I mean, that could be a new Barbie moment. I mean, that could be green is the new pink. Okay. And then moving into next year, we've got some amazing titles. We've got a new Bridget Jones.
No way.
Yes, which I can't wait. Oh. Mad about that. Another Avatar. You know, lots of great family content.
We need to get cinema people on this podcast more often, John, so I know what's going on in the cinema.
So it is music to my ears, but I'm not surprised because we've got visibility of the slate, you know, going into 2026, and it just looks phenomenal. You've got films such as It Ends With Us. So the Blake Lively film, which is in cinemas now, which, you know, a fairly small release, but it's a number one film. You know, it's a best-selling book, but really you know, TikTok has really helped drive the noise around that film. So it is just, it is great when you see a movie that just, you know, sort of comes from nowhere, that no one, I'm sure the studios will disagree, but, you know, it took us by surprise. We didn't think it would do as well as it did. So those sort of films that just pop out, which is great.
Rachel, do you get to cinema enough, and do you, how do you feel about the, you know, this growth in the UK entertainment and media market as well?
I do not get to the cinema enough. Pre-recording, Claire and I, yes, exactly, Claire and I were talking about the Everyman in Crystal Palace, which is my local and my favourite. And I, in theory, need no excuse to get down there, because as Claire and I were also talking about, these days a cinema experience is often not just about seeing the film. It's about going to this beautiful cinema that's got really comfy chairs, although for me they need to be not too comfy, otherwise I might fall asleep. You know, good snacks.
Not in the outdoor, obviously.
Obviously not. Good snacks, you know, lovely little bar that maybe you can just linger at afterwards with your friends and have a little drink or whatever. And it's a whole experience. So I absolutely look forward to going to the cinema more, and I'm going to be doing that now that I know everything that's going to be on. And I'm not, on the other hand, surprised to hear about the upward trajectory of the entertainment industry in a general context. I think a lot of it is connected to the things we've already discussed on this podcast, which is those collective moments that I think we are seeking more than we thought we might do. If someone asked us the same question in the middle of 2020, there was a lot of talk about the world moving to this low touch economy where people won't want to spend as much time in person or in a crowd environment. I just think all of that has receded back into human nature, which is that there are some things that are just better in person and some things that we really get from being in a crowd, watching a gig, watching a concert, you know, if you're a classical music fan. I used to, with some friends of mine, go to these tiny little churches in central London where they'd have these little, you know, you'd pay like a fiver and you'd listen to this wonderful little classical music quartet or something in these beautiful settings, and nothing beats those experiences. You cannot relive them in a digital context. They need to be out there in person. So I think that is also fueling the growth of the entertainment industry, is people want those experiences more than they ever did before. And you can see it in the fact that we're turning cinema experiences into these add-ons to these real life environments. You know, it's about turning up to the cinema dressed up, or spending your day in the cinema seeing more than one film, or watching a live gig or concert that you couldn't get to because the singer is so famous and the tickets are so expensive you couldn't make it there. But second best thing is seeing it in the cinema with a couple hundred other people. That doesn't surprise me at all. And I think, long may it live. You know, this is a really important part of our lives. It's not just about consumption or anything that fuels that consumption, such as advertising. It's about human experience, and human connection. We need to encourage it, protect it, you know, grow it, etc.
Yeah, saying that, I'm going to bring it right back to advertising.
Which pays for all of this. Which, so, of course, you know, and that's a fundamentally important part.
And it's a great point for cinema. You know, we friend of Exchange Wire, Mike Follett from Lumen, works in attention. And he often speaks of cinema as like, it's the point for attention. You cannot escape that giant screen in front of you. If an advertiser wants attention on their ad, buy a cinema ad. It's true. And it's, you know, it's part of why it's such a proposition. And it's great to see people having the communal experiences and going back. And it'll be great to see advertisers reaping the benefits again from that.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. I mean, both Lumen and Amplified Intelligence, has been a number of studies across the globe, I think 5 or 6, measuring attention and, you know, how much of a 30-second ad is consumed. And it's, you know, 24 seconds for cinema, and then diminishing returns. Obviously, the smaller the screen and platform, you know, the less attention is paid. And I've mentioned second screening, but it's still not socially, and long may it continue not to be, it's not socially acceptable to have your phone out in the cinema. You are there, you're a captive audience, you're paying attention. And increasingly, you mentioned Everyman, you know, if we are to be lured out of our, you know, our homes to experience, whether it's film, music, it's got to be a great environment. So the rise of, you know, the great, you know, the boutique, the independent cinema, Everyman, Curzon, and, you know, the sort of more premium multiplexes like Omniplex, just launched in the UK, and Showcase, where it is a great experience to... It's the best possible experience, I would argue, to watch a film. You're not going to be getting up and making a cup of tea. You're not going to be distracted by your kids. You know, you're focused. And it's, I think as well, it's the, which we've not mentioned, the sort of mindfulness, the fact that you are switching off for a couple of hours. And the brands, the advertisers who are part of that, you know, benefit from that too, that you, the ads are seen as part of the experience. And you don't, You know, a lot of our research shows that, yeah, people feel that, you know, that is, you know, once the Pearl and Dean, papa, papa, won't sing the whole thing. When you hear that, and then it's like, ah, okay, we're here, we can relax.
Exactly. It brings back not just a feeling of nostalgia, but it's the comfort that's associated with it, right? And I think everyone, you know, if they're lucky enough in life, has got lovely childhood memories of being in the cinema. What's great about the cinema experience is that it is almost frozen in time to a certain extent. It's still that lovely dark room with the high quality advertising. Yeah. The whole reason that you're there is to be entertained. Mm. And advertisers want nothing more than to be seen rather as entertainment over anything else.
Yeah.
So it's an incredible environment, really.
And you've got the trust piece as well. You know, as a brand, what content you will be appearing alongside. So, I mean, you can't really underestimate. Yeah, highly brand safe.
Amazing. Well, we'll call it a day there. I'm personally looking forward to seeing Moana 2. That's the one. That's the one I will be able to take my daughter to see
Mufasa
this year
as well. That's Mufasa, coming out, which is the Lion King. Yeah, that's another one.
Wow.
And then Paddington. Of course.
Well, I'm just so excited about. I've only just learned about that. That is extraordinarily exciting. Have we got Hugh Grant back as a baddie?
No.
Damn it! He was so good in Paddington 2.
And that Paddington 2 is in my top 10 favourite films. I loved it.
Love it.
So I cannot wait to see Paddington.
Now, hang on, is it a Christmas film? Or?
Yes, great.
So it's coming out for Christmas.
Perfect. Yeah. I'll put that on the list. Yeah. Yes. The last thing I went to see at the cinema was Paw Patrol Mighty Movie, which my daughter absolutely loved. But hopefully I'll go and see something more age appropriate for me at some point. But
see Gladiator.
Yeah, that'll be on
or
the
Joker,
list for sure.
I mean, that looks good.
Really want to see Twisters.
That's doing really well as well. Really well. Yeah.
I will call it a day there. Okay. Claire, it was a real pleasure. Thank you so much for coming into the studio and for the chat. It was lovely to have you.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been great fun.
You're more than welcome. We'll have you back. And Rachel, thank you as always.
My pleasure. Hopefully you'll have me back too.
Yeah, we'll see about that.
Less choice in the matter.
And thank you all for listening. That was the Mad Tech Podcast.